Welcome to Bootleg Avocado, bringing you stories in the food startup world. We are broadcasting from New York City. I'm Mario Rodriguez.
And I'm Anthony Nichols.
And we're here to bring you yet another startup story, really showcasing the person behind it and exactly what they're, how they get to their point to where they are now. So, we're going to be talking, today's guest is going to be Lucas Sin from Junzi.
Culinary director extraordinaire.
Okay.
And we also have to, I think, what we're going to do is we're going to ask him how he pronounces Junzi or Junzi or Junzi
or Junzi.
Junzi or Junzi. So we're going to have a lot of, he's a really interesting guy, very smart guy. Very young guy, and they're Junzi's on their fourth location. Their recent Bryant Park flagship store was opened, and I was able to go over there and taste some food.
Okay.
I'm really
gonna do today, right?
We're going to be tasting some more food as well, some bowls and bings.
Okay,
and I'm really excited to hear his thoughts on this up and coming, developing QSR.
Yeah, and then just Chinese food in general, for me, I'm not the biggest fan just because it's I just don't feel well right after I eat it. And I usually get things like beef and broccoli or, I don't know, any of those.
Why don't you try to be a little more creative?
And get what?
And get something different. Get beef and broccoli. Get,
Kung Pao. Sometimes I just want some beef and broccoli.
Kung Pao chicken.
Kung Pao chicken's good. General Tso's chicken. Yeah.
The issue is with the broccoli. What do they do? Do they pre-cook it and then cook it again and then throw sauce on it? Because I feel
it's
like
pretty green sometimes. So I don't know.
I think you get a difference between it's either crunchy, hard crunchy,
or
the
frozen
beyond.
Yeah.
It just melts into like soy sauce and So I mean, you do have your level of quality. That's for sure. Yeah. And as you get, Chinatown, you go to Chinatown, get some good food, But Junzi and Lucas Sin are really trying to bring that to every man and every person out there by going out there to conquer the QSR world, just like everyone else.
Right. So we'll be back with Lucas Sin. On today's episode, we have Lucas Sin of Junzi. Lucas, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
The man is here.
Yeah, we're excited for this. He brought food.
Yeah, I brought food.
And it smells really, really good. I'm not sure how we're going to be able to talk and eat at the same time, but I think we'll be able to do it.
Yeah, I think we can. So, Lucas, tell us a little bit about Junzi and the food that you've also brought.
So, Junzi is we're a Chinese fast casual restaurant. We have four locations now as of mid-2019. Three of them are in New York, and the first one we opened was in New Haven, Connecticut. It's pretty straightforward. It's just Chinese fast casual food, but the interesting thing is there aren't many, if any, out there that are doing Chinese food this way.
Yeah.
And the whole company is based on this idea that Chinese food should be everyday food, the way Mexican food now is everyday food for Americans, the way Italian food is everyday food.
Now, I do have to say, growing up in Jackson Heights, Queens, we had our local Chinese takeout, and they never had food like this ever.
Mm-hmm.
And they, is that Buddha's palm?
Yeah, that's Buddha's palm.
So there's no Buddha's palm in my
Chinese.
So that's definitely something we want to pick your brain on and what your thoughts on it and what your experience has been with that.
I mean, we can go into it, but you guys should dig in while
I see that. And so what,
just posting on for you guys.
Yeah, we're definitely going to be posting pictures as well. I took some pictures.
Uh-huh.
And so what's this first bowl?
So the first bowl that you're having is a tomato and pork bowl. It's kind of our best seller at all our locations. So the sauce is tomato and eggs, which is every Chinese auntie, every Chinese mother's, they make that at home. It's a basic home style sauce, but it's really nostalgic for a lot of Chinese kids.
Mm.
So we serve that with a braised pork, a Chinese cauliflower, pickled daikon. The second bowl you got is a furu sesame bowl, and that's kind of our take on, that sesame sauce that you get at Chinese takeout places.
Yeah.
So it's pretty straightforward, but we add a bunch of ingredients in there that make it a little bit more savory. This one is with chicken that's marinated in ginger and scallion, and then we got some Buddha's palm. Buddha's palm is interesting that you bring it up because it's kind of like, I'm sure you guys know chayote.
Yeah.
So chayote and Buddha's palm are the same thing.
Yeah.
Chayote is a Mexican vegetable that over basically 300-400 years makes its way the wrong way around over to Taiwan.
What did somebody do? How did that happen?
It's
got to be through some like sailing and shipping.
It goes to Brazil, and then the French take it from Brazil. It goes upwards into Northern America from Mexico, like up, and then into Spain and all this stuff. And then probably the Silk Road is how it ends up in China. And what's interesting is it's the same vegetable, and it's huge, right? It's huge in China. But then...
Almost like a watermelon size?
No, huge as in
popularity. A Buddha's palm the size of a watermelon?
Oh, no, it would be insane.
Very, like, GMO.
Yeah. And so, like, it's just cool to see, like, vegetables that aren't from China being super popular in China and being cooked, like, really home style, right?
Do you feel like you have to really go through a lot of education for the customers in terms of, like, what's that?
Since we're doing an industry kind of podcast,
yeah.
The short answer is, like, no, you actually really shouldn't. Because the more time you spend trying to educate someone why they should eat something or should care about something, the more obstacles
right.
you go through before you get to eat that food.
Right.
A lot of what Gen Z is about is like, yeah, there's like this deep story and immigration history behind it or whatever.
Right.
But like at the end of the day, it just needs to be everyday, decent, simple, good food.
Good food.
The way that you can eat like Monday to Friday. Mm. You know, like it can't be overwhelming. It can't be insane. You can't think to yourself, hey, this is going to be a crazy ethnic experience.
Right.
You have to be like, oh, I'll just go in and grab a taco and burrito. Nobody goes into Dos Toros or Chipotle thinking, wow, let's think about Mexican history for a second here.
Or right? think about what their ingredients
yeah.
that they're using.
Yeah. And they, if they wanted to, they can, because there should be a certain depth in the story behind the food, right? They should be able to dig into it, but they shouldn't be required to do so in order to eat something.
And I think, too, the fact is when food comes to – and I'm not – you know, obviously I live here, so I understand it better, and I would understand it better if I was somewhere else internationally. But how does, you know, Chinese food translate in England, or how does it translate in other countries?
Yeah.
However, here in the United States, we know what happens to cuisines when they come here.
Yeah.
They come here to be really kind of slaughtered and die
and
a terrible
and
death.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so you just go on and on and on in terms of Mexican food. I mean, has been pretty much
Tex-Mexified.
Oh, like, my God. Like, you cannot.
Tex-Mex coming back? I heard it is.
It is. It must be, right? I don't know. Chinese-American food is kind of coming back.
Think so.
Like, everyone's going to be nostalgic for 20 years before the moment they're in. And so, like, Chinese-American food in the 90s must have been, like, this crazy thing, right? Like, Panda Express started in the 80s, really blossomed in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
There are people doing amazing Chinese-American food here in New York.
Yeah.
Kings County Imperial is incredible, for example. Husband and wife who just have loved Chinese food their whole life and cooked in Chinese American restaurants because in Rhode Island that was the best restaurant to work at.
Right.
And then they just like opened this place and like, yeah, Chinese American food is good. Like, egg foo young, do it again with like local ingredients. And they're not like changing it up too much, but they're saying this is like by today's standards should be tasty, healthy, and edible and all stuff.
Right.
But yeah.
And you know, I think another obstacle is the idea that. Chinese traditionally are just, you know, incredible merchants and businessmen.
Yeah.
And the idea of the Chinese takeout is now, it's a perfect business.
It's a really great business.
I mean, I'll tell you, the takeout in my old neighborhood in Jackson Heights has been there over 25 years on the same corner.
Right.
And pumping out food day
and
in,
that place
day out.
Probably has food that's very similar to the Chinese takeout joint that I go to on Seamless or whatever.
Right.
Or in Connecticut. Or
right.
I bet if I was like Illinois or my kind of like parents-in-law, so to speak, get Chinese takeout in like deep Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And you can expect that General Tso's chicken to taste exactly the same as the one you're getting in Jackson.
Absolutely. Totally.
And
yeah.
They're not, there's no like McDonald's corporation behind it saying like, this is the recipe, guys. This is how you do it.
No.
This is through cousins and like this like crazy network of like people. and like Chinese people kind of like, they plan it on an individual scale, but there's no like corporatization. That's why Jinzi exists, right? They're two big brands of Chinese food and that's it. Mm. In the top 50 food brands, there's something like 13 or 14 Mexican brands. But there are only two Chinese brands, and they're more Chinese restaurants than Mexican restaurants.
You know, it's I think also the idea that, and this is really delicious, by the way.
Yeah, I'm just digging in. I haven't talked for the past 10 minutes.
Mario hasn't said anything. He's just like eating all the bowls. How do you feel about the idea that authentic cooking comes from grandparents and great-grandparents and all that stuff? But I always find, as someone, you know, sitting down with my grandmother, who's Puerto Rican, and we're talking about Puerto Rican food and Puerto Rican cuisine.
Wow.
I know we can braise pork a lot faster and easier than my grandmother does it.
Yeah.
But she's like, no way, you're not going to touch the way we do this. This is the way we do it.
Yeah.
Do you find that a lot in terms
of... Yeah, I find that a lot. The good, best example for Junza is we have wok, right? So a lot of Chinese cuisine is based off of this wok. And that itself is an understatement, because all of the cuisine revolves around the fact that these woks can cook at very high temperatures in very short amounts of time. Mm. And they've engineered the whole brigade, so to speak, or the whole kitchen to revolve around this wok. So Chinese kitchens, the physics of Chinese kitchens are different from French kitchens, which are most Western kitchens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Western kitchens have a fish station, a meat station, a pasta station, whatever. That doesn't exist. It's just the wok station and then the other stations that aren't wok. So it's entirely based on equipment, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So if woks are so integral to Chinese cooking, A, some of our restaurants don't have woks. It's kind of... you know, inflammatory for a lot of like traditional Chinese.
So somebody would come in there and be like, where's the wok?
Exactly. Or some of my locations that do have woks entirely have cooks that aren't Chinese. So then you have people who come through and like chefs who are mostly like this man.
It's like, no.
Yeah, Chinese people don't have the Chinese people are the only people that have like the gusto or whatever to work woks. Non-Chinese people have no idea how to work woks.
Uh-huh.
You're like, that's total bullshit. No way, right? Look at this guy. African American gentleman came in, used to work at Forever 29. Now he's just ripping on this
wok. Killing
the
wok.
No, it's got to do with like trading and like
you know
the industry speak is like you have to optimize your operations so that you can train people who might not have been part of the industry before being part of the industry. You have to make sure that in places where you don't have the BTUs or you don't have the gas to support a wok, that you should have another piece of equipment that can produce the same level of food.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think it's also understanding that the wok is a perfectly designed equipment for what it does, you know, and it's been around for thousands of years and, you know, it's the preferred only way to do it.
Yeah. But sometimes, you know, in the context of like opening a fast casual restaurant in New York where you don't have guys who've been working on woks forever, you don't have, you know, like you have to be realistic about those sort of things. Back of house. That's the type of thing I would never go to my grandma and tell her I don't have a wok at the new restaurant I opened. I would never say that.
She'd be like, yeah, it's in the back.
Why? What would she say?
Hopefully,
like,
if she eats the food, like, she would.
What would her response
be like?
Like, can't
be
good.
How do you cook? What is the? How do you possibly get food hot?
Right.
You know.
Mm.
So.
Yeah. And also get the nice sear and like the high heat allows for so much more technique and
I mean, I love using a wok to cook at home. Just like for I use a wok all the time.
Yeah.
I use a wok for my, like, if I'm making like broccoli or sauteing spinach or I always use a wok
For steaks, that sort of thing, even. So I mean, my goal is one day, if you walk into an Italian restaurant and making pasta and you walk into the back and they just have like these little woks at the back, because woks are perfect for tossing. Why the hell would you toss in the skillet if you got woks?
Yeah.
If that happens in New York, then you know that Junza, among other Chinese restaurants, has made an impact on the industry. Like, people are seeing into China for technique to like further their own culture and their own cuisine.
Uh-huh.
They don't need to be making like Chinese Italian fusion food.
Right.
They just have to see the value in this like movement of the wok and then be able to
tools and the technique. Yeah.
There's actually one restaurant, I forget what it's called. They have a Michelin star in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And they have little tiny induction woks for pasta. They just rip.
And it just kind of works. It works perfectly for what they do.
Yeah. What's the QSR in Boston with the robots?
Spice.
Spice. Isn't there Aren't the bowl?
Yeah, they're automated bar flipping pigs. Yeah,
yeah, automated. And I think, you know, and they're MIT guys put together this whole thing.
And Danielle, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think that's where I think QSR gets, and I think these guys can be, you know, extremely successful and make sense. But I think, you know, you're dictating what's dictating this whole proposition is that it's authentic, good food, period, end of story. There's no technology, there's no branding. Yeah. I mean, there is, but it's not the main focus.
At this point in time, I would have to say that a lot of that tech needs to be hidden from your day-to-day customers. Like some of it, like some people have negative reactions to it because they're like, oh, people aren't making food. If anything, it lacks the benefit of seeing a real human being making that food.
Right.
And the best place, in my opinion, the best case study is QSR in China, right? Like one of my favorite restaurants is called, it's a hot pot restaurant, it's a fish hot pot restaurant. And what they've done is they have basically gigantic Nespresso machines at the back that dispense hot pot, like broth.
Broth.
So you put broth into the water and then you have your spice packet and it extrudes, it kind of basically presses it through like an espresso pod. So you press the spice into the broth and then at a click of a button back of house, you have hot pot broth in like a 400 square foot restaurant. It's crazy, right? And like they've like, that's the type of technology that allows you to operate effectively in QSR.
Well, it helps you.
You see it, right?
It also helps move things along. Yeah. It helps things to, it evolves. And, you know, where grandma might be like, you know, this is what the hell is this? You know, there are areas where things can be improved and bettered. So how are we for a time?
Good. So let's take a quick little break.
Yeah, we're going to take a little
back
break.
With Lucas. You're going to be answering our empathy question.
Incredible.
So it's kind of like a little icebreaker, but we'll be back with Lucas in. Welcome back to Bootleg Avocado, bring you stories in the food startup world. So we have Lucas Sin of Junzi here.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you actually pronounce Junzi?
Junzi is what most people pronounce it to be. The Chinese way of pronouncing it is Junzi.
Junzi.
Junzi. So kind of like June, like month, and like pizza.
Junzi.
Junzi is how I say it, but Junzi is totally acceptable.
Okay.
Junzi. Now the word does have some...
Junzi means person with integrity.
Person
so it's kind of
integrity.
This philosophical term for the type of person you want to become. Uh-huh. And like before Confucius, it's really an old term. We came up with it because we were thinking, oh, we should call ourselves Chive or, you know, like, you know, we could call it something like, oh, like that's what fast casual restaurants are named after, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
And then we're like,
thing.
And then one of our advisors said, what do you guys want to be like in 15 years from now? Like what's important to you and the values of Junzi?
Right.
Like cooking honestly with integrity and like appealing to the best version of yourself that you can be at all times is kind of what we really vibed with. So we named it that.
I read an interview with Gordon Ramsay who said successful restaurants have two syllables. It can be one, you know, usually
you,
one word. One word, two syllables are usually like the really super
one better one.
Expensive one. Successful
Dig
in.
Restaurants.
Wow.
I just think Nobu.
Nobu. Wow.
Nobu.
Morimoto. That's a tough one.
Morimoto. That's three. But it still has that, like,
no.
You know, it's like, you know, you use words like Baba or
Chick Check.
You know, it has a ring to it when I'm going somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
The
Three syllables max.
That sounds good. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Gramercy Tavern. But no, you know, you think about per se.
I mean, when you're thinking about, like, it's the hard ones that are, like, whole sentences of, like, languages you can speak. That's, like, the top. Il buco, whatever.
Il buco de picosca,
there's no way. There was a famous Chinese-American chef that I met when I was in college, and he told them we were opening this restaurant. And he asked us what it was called, and we said, Junzi. And he said, nobody's going to come because they can't pronounce it. And I said, okay. Here we are 4 years later.
Here we are,
yeah.
and it's a great name, and it has the two syllables. So I think you guys are going to be continued success.
Recipe for success right there.
Mm-hmm.
So Mario, do we have a card for our good friend?
We do. Empathy cards.
Uh-huh.
As I'm eating. So a little icebreaker. Just kind of, you know, be as honest as you can.
Mm-hmm. So anyone.
Anyone, yeah. And we can do it.
There you go.
Good read.
So it says, what are your most audacious aspirations?
Mm.
Oh, we already talked about it earlier. The walk is a really good example for audacious aspiration. What's his name? Albert Adria?
Yeah.
Franz.
He was in New York a couple of years ago, and I went up to him and I was like, I'm Lucas, we're in Chinese Girl. And the first thing he said, he's like, you know what? I said, what? He said, if it were not for the Chinese Cultural Revolution, we would all be playing catch up to the Chinese in the culinary world. So the only reason we eat French food and cook in a French style, right, is because China stopped exporting its culture, you know, after the Second World War.
Wow.
And he was just like,
oh my God.
That was like the first thing he said. That was the first thing he said to you.
And he's like, totally, I was like, you're totally right. There's so much of sophisticated technique. And as I said, it's a whole other universe, it's a whole other set of physics out there, right? And Chinese food, like every single cuisine can learn from Chinese cuisine, whether it's from agriculture to ingredients to like fermentation technique, all the way to like cooking, chopping techniques, like
to serving and like, just the preparation.
Yeah. And it's a little brash for me to say this, but I say it in interviews a lot. I really do think Chinese food is the best food in the world. If it's not the best food in the world, it's the type of food most worth learning from today, I think. And New York is a really, really good place to see that because of the regional diversity of Chinese food. Restaurants are opening around here. Like people are starting to believe in identity and empowerment. So you can like cook Chinese food and have people like listen to the story. All of that stuff, I think it's really, now is the best time to cook Chinese food and learn from Chinese food.
Mm.
And there's still so much to learn because we're in this, I don't know, you know, this American food filter that kind of, and I mean, it's getting better and better constantly as I mean, as business starts to discover each of the cuisines, I think there are a lot of investors who put together money and plans based on how they feel they could sell a cuisine.
Yeah.
And I think we still have a lot of learning to do.
And regional specificity is like on the rise for sure. Like Oaxacan food in the last like 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Like, oh, Oaxaca specific, not just Mexico, just Oaxaca.
Just Oaxaca, right.
And, you know, I'm like, oh, very cool. And then you start trying, and then once you start seeing that regional diversity, that's when chefs can go and say, oh, I'll learn specifically from this region, because once I have that constraint, I can actually go deeper and deeper and deeper.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of research on Mexican cuisine a couple of years ago, and I did a big event, and I put radishes on all the tacos.
Sure.
And people were very shocked by that because they were like, radishes, that's so weird. So, but they do use, they have radishes. They're beautiful radishes in Mexico. But there's this, I don't know what it is. I'm not sure.
Yeah. You lose a lot during the process of translation. And mind you, for Chinese food, which is basically the only cuisine I could speak to. Like, we've been trying to translate food in Chinese food in the U.S. for the last 150 years. Right? Without a recipe, without a corporate entity saying, this is what defines Chinese food. And we're saying like passing.
This is the base of it.
Yeah,
this is
cousins or cousins. People are new. People are coming all the time. Like for 150 years, we've been trying to do this. And finally, now is the only time when there's information that can be floated around and passed in an effective manner, so that we can like dig deeper faster.
We were discussing earlier how the business model of the Chinese takeout is so successful and so well done. Do you find the inner struggle, that inner struggle with practical businesses standing in the way of authentic cuisine because of that, just that idea? I mean, even, you know, just to add to that too, the Greek diner.
Yeah.
You know, every Greek diner is exactly the same.
Korean grocery stores.
And, you know, it's like, we're doing this way.
Yeah.
And I've done some consulting with Greek restaurants where you have the son's like, Dad, we gotta do this. And the father's like, no, I've never even heard of that in my life.
Exactly. I mean, for Junza, it's a little different because the founders of Junza and the core people that started this restaurant were not Chinese Americans. We came to this country for school. We stayed after school and have been building restaurants and working in the food industry here. There's an interesting relationship and kind of like dichotomy between American-born Chinese restaurateurs that are going back to the generation before and revitalizing it and saying,
sure,
this is what you have to do. And there's a lot of success. And once you demonstrate success, more people can do it. The best example, obviously, is Yum's Foods. Another one is Nam Wan Tea Parlor. In New York, like, these two brands are so strong, and they rep Chinatown, the two Chinatowns so hard, Flushing and, you know, Cantonese Chinatown.
Should we give Calvin
a
shout out?
Exactly. As an ABC.
Just a real kind of
who's this
stand-up guy. Calvin Ang, who's now at Wing Sun.
Yeah.
He connected Lucas and I together, so.
Doing the same thing, a similar thing at Wing Sun. It's like, Josh is like a Taiwanese-American guy. It's like saying, hey, let's look at Taiwanese-American food real quick.
Sure.
And then those people have the savvy, you know, whether it's social media design or whatever, to give new life to some of the food. Existed before,
and get that
business sense from before,
and get that sort of that attention that everyone's, you know, like, wow, what are they doing?
On
what's
the other
interesting?
Hand, you have immigrants that are saying, "Hey, you've never really thought about Hunan style cuisine. Let me show you what's up because I'm from Hunan."
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming here. They do their, you know, degree at NYU or whatever. And they graduate. Like, let's talk about Hunan for a second. Let's talk about this specific type of dry pot, which is a new type of hot pot you didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Sichuan food. And so, like, Mala Project, Dian Kitchen,
uh-huh.
Tang Hot Pot, all these places that are popping up are exactly that, because they're allowed to be regional because they're from that place.
Sure.
And so they have a different, they also have a unique sort of like audience, because it's these kids that are going to school. I think I read somewhere, somebody told me there are 30,000 new Chinese students in the US every year. That's the biggest portion of international students. And these are the people that have phones. They're on WeChat, they're on Instagram, they're gonna like shut you out, they're gonna carry your business
mm-hmm.
when you have to tell the rest of the world that, let's say for example, Northern Chinese food is worth eating. These are the people that are gonna send that message out. And so those are a lot of the key early adopters of our brand that we see. So we try to open restaurants near universities so we can tap into that network.
That's smart. That's great outreach, simple outreach. Yeah, the community right there.
And it's growing every single day. There's so many new people coming here.
So what did I just have here? Sorry.
You're eating a bing. So a bing is basically a Chinese wrap, Chinese flatbread.
Bing time.
So that's what you're eating, a sweet bay beef bing. So that's a kind of like old school traditional bing. Beef shank has been braised, and then it's kind of like crunchy beef with tendons and stuff.
So how would you do it? It's basically like it's wrapped up
in a bing that's made of flour and water.
Okay.
So there are a lot of different types of bings. This is a chun bing, which is a spring bing. Basically, it's just flour and water, kind of like a tortilla.
Okay. Rolled up like burrito style, right?
Kind of like a wrap,
Yeah.
And then there are other types of bings, like you might have heard of jian bing, which is Mr. Bing is making a lot of jian bing here in New York.
Mm.
That's a type of crepe made from mung bean flour.
Yeah.
Momofuku makes a different type of bing that's kind of in between a naan and a brioche type of thing, where it's like a little fluffier.
More hybrid.
Yeah. So, I mean, bing is just our word for flatbread, and every culture has a flatbread. China has a couple thousand of them. And so we make the jian bing as our wrap.
It's really delicious, really easy to eat. Thanks. It's light. It's really...
Yeah, everything we've been eating is light.
Which is a little bit of a departure from most people's experience of Chinese food in the U.S.,
yeah.
where they think to themselves, oh, it's going to be crazy. Like, the flavor's going to be insane. Like, it's going to be so delicious. There's so much and like so many new things going on in my palate.
Yeah.
But for me, this is kind of like a change in a little bit of my culinary philosophy in the last year. That you actually kind of want to like sing the song of the vegetables and keep it kind of light. That's what everyday food is. Right. If I was opening a full service restaurant and only had people's attention once in their lifetime,
mm-hmm.
they're only going to come to the restaurant once. You want to like throw flavor in there and like make it like this insane big thing.
Right. Boulders.
But when you want them to come once or twice a week, you're actually saying, "Hey, this is home style, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's simpler. It's a little bit more rustic. Like you don't have to go out on a limb to try to eat this food.
Right. It's not a special occasion type thing. You can have this at lunch. You can have some noodles.
Yeah. And those of us who do QSR know that. Repeat customers that's the gold mine. That's what you really need to demonstrate to people.
Mm.
Right.
You want that guy like me who's like really routine and eats like the same, tries to eat the
same
thing all the time.
Either bacon, egg, and cheese, and then for lunch, it's either sweet green, dig in.
Because I don't want to think about like what I'm eating, and I also don't want to eat a certain way because you feel like you're cheating on your diet.
Yeah,
you're just like, it's not like you can have like a, you know, it's like you feel bad if you can have a bacon cheeseburger on Monday for lunch.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And people want to eat healthier, lighter food.
Yeah.
So
should we talk about his background?
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, so
I,
let's do that.
You know, and I wanted to give you a little leeway too. And I kind of want to, I also want to blow you up a little bit too. I want to say, you know, when I met you, you know, you're obviously a young guy, but you're not a kid. And you're just, I've just been really impressed with your ability to kind of translate what you want to do and have a historical perspective to it as well. If you could just give us like your background, like what's your background in terms of let people know what your background is and how you have come to this position in your life.
So I'm from Hong Kong originally. I moved over here when I was 18 for college, which was 7 years ago.
So you guys do the math. 18, 7 years now.
7 years ago.
This is a really good one.
Mario was having the
mushroom.
Garlic chili mushroom thing. So
the chili's really good on that.
Beach mushroom and so fermented chilies.
Fermented chilies.
And then basically a hot pot seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
That style of it's deep fried sauce, which is a Chinese technique of deep frying liquids to activate the aromatics and the flavors.
That's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really good.
That's vegan right there.
This?
Yeah.
Wow.
Everything except for the wrap is gluten free.
Wow.
So, you know, that's what
that's
the type of thing you want to do. Anyway, so I opened this restaurant when I was in Hong Kong when I was in high school, when I was 16. Private kitchen. That's how like a lot of Chinese chefs open restaurants in Hong Kong. The rent as high as you do it in your apartment. in a newspaper factory.
Oh really?
Taught my friends how to cook. Taught them how to like talk about wine and all this stuff, and then you're serving this food, and basically you would get on a shuttle bus and then you'd get transported to this newspaper factory. You'd go upstairs and then inside the wine cellar, a bunch of like 16-year-olds just like serving you food. And taking yourself way too seriously, but it's like a good time. Like pop-ups, there's something special about pop-ups in terms of cooking like recklessly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if it's good, you're never going to have it eaten.
Right.
You know, like that type of mentality.
Yep.
So that's how I kind of like started thinking about food. And then while I was in college, I spent every single weekend doing pop-ups in my dorm. I also spent all my winters and my summers cooking in Japan, eventually in fine dining, kaiseki cuisine.
Wow.
Did you have any time to study in school? You doing pop-ups?
I really loved it. The food was the thing. And you get to a certain point, you're like, I literally could not do anything else. This is it for me for the rest of my life, probably. And so that's what you kind of like. Spend your body
good. Like, screw this history test. I have to prep.
Yeah, exactly. We were prepping Thursday night, 10 p.m. onwards. And then Friday, we would serve literally 200 people. 200 people in the dorm room.
Yeah, I was just saying, your room.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's
in the basement. It was.
What school did you go to?
I went to Yale.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Went to Yale University, did pop-ups.
That's
but it's like,
time.
You know, food pop-ups are like the mixtape for rappers.
Exactly.
You know, like for chefs.
Yeah,
like,
when you're like a young.
Do your little pop-up. Get your name out there.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, it was just like, hey, all these like Yale kids spend all their time in their head. Let's like give them a broom and like make them wash dishes and like put food together. And
I'll make
like,
them wash dishes.
Yeah, you like, roll your sleeves up and you're just like, oh, there's something special about like camaraderie and all this stuff. Like everything I loved about working in professional kitchens up in that point, I thought it was important for like Yale kids to also like get a sense of. And proudly, a lot of these kids who started cooking at this pop-up with me. Are now in the food business, right? Whether they're doing sustainability work or they're teaching people how to cook sustainably in Rome or, you know, whatever it is, it's really a good network out there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that kind of was happening on the weekend, and then I dove into Japanese cuisine because my understanding about like 4 or 5 years ago was Japanese food is the best food in the world.
And you were still at Yale?
Still at Yale. And then just staging, basically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, on the last summer, I was in Japan. I was cooking at this 3-Michelin-star place called Kikunoi. And the chef sent me down, like, hey, so tell me about your aspirations and all these things. And then we were talking. He told me his story. He basically runs a restaurant that's really quite old that his father started. He, thinking French food was the best food in the world 50 years ago, went to France. In France, had the realization that he should think about the food that's in his blood. So went back to Japan, took over his father's restaurant, made it the best kaiseki restaurant in Japan. And I just like had this moment, it's like, oh, I'm in Japan thinking Japanese food is the best food in the world. But like, you're just, what about the food that's in my blood that I've been eating my whole life? And
sure.
I cook with my dad and all this stuff. And then you suddenly think, oh, wait, Chinese food is actually insane. It's actually so important. And then so you go back to the US, you meet a couple of people, other Chinese students who have a similar kind of like thinking from an entrepreneurial or a design standpoint, and you put the team together and say, hey, let's, if you wanted to make an impact on Chinese food in the US, the way to do it is QSR. So you start doing QSR.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I don't believe that Chinese food would have too big of an impact at the fine dining level outside of basically New York and San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's why we started with QSR in the middle of Connecticut, to prove to ourselves that regular America would be interested in what we're doing too. So that's how we started about 3-4 years ago, and now we've opened a couple of restaurants here in New York.
And your whole team has been, or is everyone yet? Is everyone from Yale?
The three co-founders were all doing their PhDs and master's degrees at Yale.
Wow.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's cool.
And everyone just sort of connected with this unified vision of doing this. And you guys are now, so now you're a fourth location.
Fourth location just opened 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, Bryant Park. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's going?
It's good, Bryant Park. What you realize 3-4 years into the industry is that location, location, location,
yeah,
right? And every store has its own life, and every store has its own audience, and its own like little thing going on. And so when we opened at Bryant Park, we had a line at the door, like 90% line for like 2 hours straight.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like going through service trying to figure out, how are we going to keep up with this? How are you going to do it? And a week later, things just kind of start clicking.
Yeah.
So it's been cool to see Chinese home style food be food that can be served at volume, which I think is our goal. And so we've started to test ourselves that way. In the short term, we're looking for other avenues of revenue. CPG is interesting for your brand, as well as for revenue. Events are really important.
Very necessary.
Yeah, and to contradict myself, I think there's something interesting going on at higher ticket prices for Chinese food. I think it would be cool if you...
But not so fine dining, as you said.
It doesn't
have
to be white tablecloth.
Right.
But it can be like thoughtful, narrative-driven,
sure,
like Chinese cuisine, mm-hmm, like multi-course. I think that would be really interesting to look into.
Regional.
Absolutely,
yeah.
I think
creative
so.
Creative and...
Ingredient-driven.
Ingredient-driven. That's the only time you get people to
excuse me,
all night.
Yeah.
Is when you go with a certain paid price, you sit down like, okay, I'm going to give you my attention for 2 hours. Whereas in the QSR, they'll give you their attention for a minute. And only say so much.
You know, it's funny because you guys are so thoughtful over there, Junza. Tell me about the fried chicken. The chicken that you guys do for college students. I always thought that was such a nice pivot.
Yeah. So for late night at Junza, we basically flip the restaurant over into, forget the vegetable forward, you know, balanced like day-to-day stuff. It's just like a late night drunk food, right?
And wait, which location is this?
Everyone that's near a university. So New Haven, NYU, and Columbia.
Oh, okay.
So New Haven, NYU, and Columbia, when it's 10:30.
Yeah, we open Junza late night, right? We call it after hours. And so we're doing fried chicken, we're doing fried rice, dumpling, just the stuff that you would expect that you would want to, that you would be craving, you know, at that time of night. So General Chu's chicken is kind of our take on General Chow's chicken. It's our signature dish for late night. And it's a pretty straightforward brined and then deep fried chicken thigh.
Mm. But done right.
It's done right. It's, you know, it's really nice ice cold batter and really hot oil. It's just, you know, you steal a little bit of things from like Japanese karate
technique. Sure.
Like tempura technique. And then you brine it the way Chinese American restaurants do. You serve it with like a sticky sauce that's got fermented tofu in it and all this stuff. It's just like, you know, too much to handle. It was like 11 a.m., like 10:30. You're like, whoa, this is actually insane. So
later when you're drunk, you're like,
yeah, and that's what Chinese Americans are so good at, like General Chow's chicken, right? Like, that's what the whole deal is. It's just like, oh, you take a bite, you're like, there's something about this that I want another bite.
Yeah.
And so realizing that that's the state we're normally in when we want to eat at that time, we decided to open late night.
And what time do you open till?
Until between 1 and 2.
I definitely want to hit. I definitely want to hit that.
I wasn't even aware of that. So,
And I think
it's kind of a little bit of a secret.
It is a little bit of a secret.
Cocktails and all this stuff. Yeah.
Well, worry. I don't know how many listeners we actually have. So we'll see as we get bigger. But I think we can pregame before we go.
Pre-game.
You can pre-game there to go.
You got to pre-game because then how are we going to taste the food? You got
to
pre-game.
A bunch of college students that like to drink and eat at gym. They like to drink at gym, so they go out and they come back right before we close after they've been to the club or whatever for the food.
And then they come back again.
That works out, yeah.
So let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, let's jump into a little bit more about Chinese food and where Junzi is. Welcome back to Bootleg Avocado, bringing you stories in the food startup world. So Lucas, let's jump a little bit more into, you know, Chinese food in general, how you're kind of applying that, you know, those techniques to what you're serving day to day, and also kind of your the growth strategy behind Junzi.
I mean, one of the most important things for every single type of restaurant, especially in the U.S., is your team and your people.
Mm-hmm.
Without those people, without that team, you're not going to be able to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how good the food is,
right.
If it's not being made. So we don't have any Chinese staff in our kitchens because older style Chinese American restaurants in particular, and a lot of Chinese restaurants too, rely on a system of labor that is kind of like separate from the rest of the system of labor in New York.
Mm.
So you might imagine, and this is a hypothetical, or rather, if you're going to open a restaurant, you might call an agency and then you tell them, I have this many walks, I need this many people, I'm going to cook this type of food.
Mm.
And then the agency will bring a bus and then all these Chinese guys would get off and then they would all work and then they'd be like, what type of food? And you'd be like, Sichuan food. And like, okay, cool, we'll make Sichuan food. They'll be there for however long. Head honcho will suddenly be like, I'm out of here. I don't want to do this. They'll get on, they get back on the bus. The rest of the team will call. You call the agency again. Another bus will come.
Another guy.
And so like that relies on Chinese immigrants coming to this country who are cooking out of necessity, right?
Mm.
They're coming and these restaurants usually allow for the cooks to live near the restaurant. They pay for the dorms, they pay for the food. They just come in here, they work, they send money home. I don't think that type of immigration is going to last forever. As I mentioned before, most Chinese people coming to the U.S. now are actually, you know, highly educated students.
Mm-hmm.
They're not coming to cook anymore. They're coming to build businesses or coming to work in banks, whatever it is. So because of that, it wouldn't be wise to business, I think, to rely in the long term on that Chinese labor force. It gets pretty simple. If you're opening a restaurant in the U.S., my belief is you should be using the labor that's here. You should be relying on the people who live here to work your restaurants. And so
also, you know, and sorry to cut you off,
yeah.
But also as an extension of your vision of sharing your culture, you're sharing on a daily basis people that have not been
exposed to it
at all.
Exactly.
And they're learning it,
exactly.
Which is actually great.
Exactly.
And it's also bringing up the next generation of people that are thinking about food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to think that people who get trained and work at Junzi can one day work in any other type of restaurant, because what they learn in the Chinese kitchen or Chinese fast casual kitchen should apply to other forms of cooking. So, I mean, bringing those people up is really important for us. We like to boast that in some stores, like our New Haven store, which is our first store, we have extremely low turnover. And there's no magic solution to how you keep that turnover down. There's no magic solution to like how you get people committed to the place they're working at. It's always got to do with building up the leadership and like fostering a community and a culture that's exciting for them. Everybody needs to have a path for growth upwards. All the employees need to either feel that they're learning something new every single day or they're going to do something new so that they can grow, not as a career. I refuse to see culinary careers, even at the QSR level, to be kind of like an in-between for what people really want to do. Hey, I'd love to, you know, I'd love to do music after I make enough money working here. So I don't love that. I think like this should be your career when
people
you're
committed
right now.
To, yeah.
I always have, it's hard for me to always meet chefs that have been like, chefs are in the food world and then they just like drop it or they don't do it. And for me, it's like, I don't know. It's, you were never really a chef if that was the case, because I think it's a lifetime way of living.
Yeah. And the reality of it is like when you're in a fast casual restaurant, you're having people that used to work at Burger King and, you know, Wendy's and, you know, places like that where a lot of the food is like press a button and food kind of like appears. There's like minimal work. But for Chinese food at this level, we don't have the benefit of having those types of equipment. We don't have the benefit of having suppliers that can pre-cut certain vegetables for you, a certain size, so that you can make that food. We have to cook every single bite in every single location. And so that requires what cooking requires: tasting, being precise, working really clean,
seasoning,
hygienically, seasoning.
And you guys, yeah, you got, your kitchens are amazing. I mean, you got a lot of stuff going on. You got a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of prep.
And so we try to, I mean, it's your job as the person who's running the kitchen to optimize those processes so that somebody who comes in who's never worked in a Chinese kitchen or even a kitchen at all before should be able within a certain number of weeks to have a good sense of how to move and how to lead and how to take initiative.
Yeah.
And that's got to do with like good documents that people can, good recipes that people can follow effectively, good hassle plans or whatever it is. Just like everything needs to be.
Flow the kitchen.
Yeah. And Chinese restaurants have had the benefit for quite a long time, a lot of them, of not doing that type of thing. Because a Chinese guy who's just been working on walks their whole life at different restaurants can come in and they'll know this stuff in their head. But having it written down so people can follow it, that hasn't really happened for a lot of Chinese restaurants.
I get it.
Okay. Yeah.
And then what's kind of the growth strategy with Jinzi?
We're looking at more spaces to open new locations. We're always trying to build more restaurants because Jinzi's goal is accessibility in every day. So accessibility means that more people need to be able to get to the food.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at different locations around New York. And hopefully one day we would expand to other markets as well.
Okay. But for now, let's kind of grow New York and then kind
of... We wouldn't want to underestimate the difference between the New York market and everywhere else. Like Sweetgreen, for example, famously moved to LA, their whole headquarters, and Nick cannot stop talking about how difficult that move was. He had like 20 or 30 locations in on the East Coast starting in DC or something, and they were like doing really, really well. They had all these supplies lined up and all this stuff. But the movement made them move to LA. It's like opening a new restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, it's different clientele. Yeah, again, on the branding end, the clientele is different.
Very tough.
You know, and I think it's even more competitive.
Yeah, it is, given
the type of food it is.
And almost every restaurant in LA has to be a destination restaurant because you have to drive there, you know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one thing, there are tons of QSRs in the United States right now with 75 to 100 locations that you've never heard of because of the idea that there's a huge country out there.
Yeah.
And I think the battle for the QSR space happens in all these big cities, and you can have $50 million of investment and be ready to open up a next location, but you can't find another location because every block is inundated with restaurants and all kinds of, it's just heavy competition in New York, LA. And I want to see more QSRs kind of going to those, you know, other up and coming cities that are, things are happening in. St. Louis, Missouri is one of them. St. Louis has got a lot of stuff going on in St. Louis.
Right.
Nashville's got a lot of its food scene, but it doesn't have any QSRs down there.
Yeah.
You know, those cities could use definitely any one of these QSRs.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it yourself, somebody's going to do it coming out of you.
That's
right.
You know?
And it's not going to be good.
It's perfectly legal. I mean,
totally. But think about the quality of the New York, New York entrepreneurial spirit, the idea, the culture, the food, and then taking that outside of, you know, the areas that all these QSRs are battling for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like,
a lot of these QSRs actually prefer to move international before they move into the middle of America. You know, Dubai, very common first step.
Yeah.
Tokyo. Because
I think everybody wants to say, hey, you know what, we've gone, you know, Dubai. And, but like you ask around and no one's ever been to that location.
Yeah.
No, we haven't been there.
It's almost like that's easier than opening in Arkansas, you know? It's crazy.
I kind of agree with that because it's the same metro mentality in those other cities. So.
Yeah.
I think that's why they say,
and you get partners out there.
Yeah,
they
partners
have their whole supply. And
of course,
you don't like you have to run that restaurant.
Yeah.
Otherwise you can hand over and get active.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But there's so many cities in the United States that are really like starting to really, I guess, I don't know if it's just, you know, pour over of culture and population that they're just starting to now think about food and different cuisines and cultures. which I think is a good thing. People need to start understanding that the bottom line is that here in the United States, all the cultures that you have encountered for so long are 10 times deeper than you could ever imagine.
And then 2 years ago, they found a 4,000-year-old noodle.
Wow.
In a
I think you I remember you were telling me that. Yeah.
Like, we've been making noodles for 4,000 years in China. Like, it's no joke.
And the fact that you got it somehow, he was able to, like, airtight. Like,
exactly. They just found it strange. Like, so they were, which means that they had taken wheat, or they think it's millet, I think. Which they milled the flour, right? And then they're extruding it, or they're adding it to water and rolling it out. Like, that's insane.
The first sous vide was like in a stone. You had to like crack it open to get the food out with like a sledgehammer.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
So there's just so many exciting things going on. And you know, it's great to, I'm so happy to have met you, because now I get access to this this amazing, exciting stuff that you guys are doing.
Yeah.
It's good, yeah.
Anybody's got any Chinese food questions, you know who to hit up.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell everyone where, if you're doing any special events, where people can reach you?
He's very
busy.
He's always doing some kind
of
event.
These things.
Follow,
yeah.
And you should definitely mention your Instagram. You know, you guys, your Instagram.
You can follow me on Instagram, lucas.sin, lucas.sin. The restaurant, Junzi, is Junzi Kitchen. So those are our two Instagram handles. We're doing events all the time. Going to do a James Beard House dinner pretty soon.
Nice.
Some
cool collab dinners, maybe centered around Oaxacan Sichuan food. Pretty exciting about that.
Oaxacan Sichuan?
Yeah. It's really interesting overlaps, because the first step for both of these, actually the final step for both of these cuisines is the chili pepper. But obviously chili peppers aren't from China. But the first step is always like layering savory qualities.
Sure.
And like that layering of flavor is interesting to think about. And Oaxacan food is blowing up. Sichuan food is blowing up. There's some interesting dialogue there. So we're doing events all the time. But if you want to come check out our restaurants, we've got a couple of locations in Manhattan. So hit us up.
Cool. All right. So, Anthony, how would you like to conclude this episode?
How would I like to conclude this episode? Well, you know, it's exciting to talk to Lucas about his vision, his strategy, and his ideas for Junzi and what's happening in the QSO part of this world. There's a lot of competition out there. It's really exciting. There's a lot of moving parts. Obviously, travel it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to have some more QSRs on our podcast and see what's going on. And I think, you know, QSR will be the method of how we
open
restaurants and serve foods. I think, you know, there will always be a place for Danielle and per se and all
and
that.
And in between too, there's always going to be a place for, you know, like $30 per head. $40 per head, somewhat creative regional cooking, mom and pop stores.
Yeah.
But I think because the QSR quality is now elevating itself, those people in the middle are really going to have to get their game together. And you're not going to go to some bad, you know, Italian restaurant because that's the only thing you can eat now.
Yeah.
You can actually go somewhere and have a moderately priced Italian meal. Who's the Italian QSR? Any Italian QSRs out there? Nothing. Pasta Flyer.
Pasta Flyer.
But it only has one location. But I mean, that idea. Where Italian QSR can do 10 times better than...
What about Sabor?
Sabor?
Sabor. Oh, you're a good point. Yeah. All that stuff. Pizza Hut. That's an Italian.
You know, and Sabor does have like the table with the food. They have like, they serve like chicken marsala, things like that.
Sabor does,
I've had many a Sabor slice. Definitely.
Especially in the airport.
They run the airport.
Yeah, they run the airports. So tell us about Speakpeace.
So, well, you know, we've been talking about this, and I've been talking about how to really kind of bring things together at the end about what exactly it is that you and I both do.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I want to encourage people to look me up. I love to talk. I love to email back and forth about all things food. So please, visit me at speakfeast.com or chefanthonynichols.com. Yes, I have two websites, which is, you know, a lot to run, I think, but I get it done.
Like double fisting websites.
Double fisting websites.
Yeah.
And Chef Anthony Nichols on Instagram. I travel the space of QSR. So if anyone has any questions or needs, just send me an email. I'd love to collaborate.
Cool. And I'm Martin Rodriguez trying to eat one of these white riblet candies.
You gotta let it soak.
Yeah, I know.
He put the whole thing in his mouth and it spit it out.
I was like a kid who's just eating something.
At least
for
it's not
time.
Video.
They tell you not to eat it and you eat it anyway.
You eat it anyway, yeah.
Anyway, I'm Martin Rodriguez from Bootleg Avocado. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Back next week with another showcased entrepreneur or chef. And don't forget to follow me at bootlegavocado.com and then Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all those things. So thanks for listening, guys. Thank you for
being on the show. Thank you so much.
Yes. Cool. Thanks, guys.